Hello and welcome to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio, a space for real conversations about relationships, healing, and what it truly takes to change. Today's guest is someone whose work has quietly transformed the lives of individuals, couples, and families around the world. Dr. Nicholas Jenner is a psychotherapist, author, and the creator of the Safe Harbor Therapeutic Approach, a model centered on emotional safety, accountability, and the courage required to build healthy relationships. Through his writing, his online practice, and his book, Our Quest for Happily Ever After, he guides people through some of the most painful and complex experiences we face: trauma, dysfunctional patterns, attachment wounds, relationship breakdowns, with a lot of his work centered around codependency and the long journey back to trust. His work is grounded, compassionate, and deeply practical. He teaches not just how to understand ourselves, but how to take responsibility for the parts of our lives we can change and how to heal from the parts we couldn't control. Nick, it's a real pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Nick, you often talk about codependency. I know your work is centered around that. For listeners who may not understand it clearly, what does codependency look like in everyday relationships?
Well, that's true. I do work with codependents and not just some. I would say that the vast majority of my clients fit that description. And codependency, of course, is we have to say first, is not a disorder. It's not in the DSM, which I personally am quite pleased about because, I mean, it would probably have some kind of medical model attached to the recovery. We're talking here about medication, of course. But codependency is a big thing, and many people struggle with it. And it's probably the biggest relationship issue that I come across. And how it manifests itself, of course, is through things like rescuing, enabling, controlling, because codependency is all about control. And really, where it comes from is childhood, where a lot of trauma comes from. People have been taught to believe that they're only valuable if they are useful to somebody. And of course, that's what they take into their adult world. So you often find in a relationship that you've got one codependent who is often, chasing somebody who's emotionally distant. And of course, that's the whole idea of that, is to try and fix and rescue them. And they believe that if they can do that, and of course, they will be loved, and it's very painful to see sometimes because it's in relationships. It means a complete loss of identity and self, which I think we're going to come to later as to how to recover from that.
Thank you. That was incredibly clearly put. And I think so many people listening will have recognized themselves in what you just described. That idea that I'll be loved if I'm useful is such a powerful driver. And as you said, it can quietly lead to a complete loss of self over time. I'd love to come back to that recovery piece with you shortly, because that's where the real hope sits. And your safe harbor approach puts emotional safety at the center of healing. What does emotional safety mean, and why is it so essential in relationships?
Well, I don't think it's just my approach. I think any approach that looks at, kind of helping relationships should have emotional safety at the center of healing. I mean, and if you're a couples therapist in particular, this is what you really should be aiming for if you're helping a couple. But I mean, of course, it's something that emotional safety is not something that happens very often in relationships, particularly when we're talking about codependency. But it's actually the backbone of every healthy relationship. It's the sense of that you can show up as your real self, with your feelings, needs, flaws and opinions without fear of being criticized or dismissed or punished. And it also has an effect on conflict. Someone who doesn't feel emotionally safe or the need to feel emotionally honest, arguments become personal attacks, or silent treatment happens. And something we're going to talk about later on, I think, which is individuality. Of course, in a safe relationship, you don't have to lose yourself to keep the peace. So emotional safety, which is the ability to show up as your genuine self, is something that, everybody should be striving for.
And what really stands out for me, Nick, is that tension you mentioned, the pull between wanting to feel safe and wanting to feel wanted. So many people sacrifice safety to avoid the fear of being alone, and that's where the self gets lost. And that's exactly why the conversation about individuality is so important, because without a sense of self, emotional safety simply can't survive. And those silent moments that you spoke about, I think it's very important for individuals to become very self-aware of their emotions. And in your book, Our Quest for Happily Ever After, you explore the patterns people repeat in love. And what do you think, what are some of these patterns? What inspired you to write about it?
Well, I mean, most of the work that I do, apart from being educated and studying, a lot of the work I do is influenced by my own personal experience. I tend to mix therapy with coaching because I believe that action is very, very important when people are trying to change something. And the book was really, the book is now, I think, about 10 years old, and I'm in the process at some point of updating it. But really, I just wanted to, to show people that, that relationships aren't something that gets formed over 3 months or 6 months or even 3 years. Our quest for happily ever after has a kind of a dual meaning. First of all, we're always looking for that, for the one. We're sold this kind of social kind of norm that we find this one person and we go into this relationship for life and down a very common path. And of course, it also means that once you find somebody who you can work with, doesn't necessarily have to be the one, but of course, then the real work starts of keeping that relationship alive every single day that you're together. And this is really what I try to aim for with the book, is look at some of the reasons why that doesn't happen. And of course, some solutions to make it happen.
Thank you for sharing that, Nick, and such valuable insight. And I think what really lands there is this idea that relationships aren't a destination, they're a daily practice. We're sold the fantasy of the one, as you mentioned, but not really taught the skill of the work. And I love that you've highlighted that shift from searching for perfection to learning how to sustain something real. But also, I think it's really very important for that acceptance as well, of learning about each other, knowing where each other's coming from, and having that self-love as well is really important, because I think when people are so giving in relationships, they do often forget about themselves and what their individual needs are as well. Many people find themselves drawn to similar types of partners, even when it causes them pain, and they adapt themselves or they change who they are just to please their partner. Why do you think these patterns run so deeply?
Well, this is a question that often codependents in particular find themselves asking themselves, and a question that they haven't, often have no idea about and often are in denial about. But I mean, they run so deeply because those patterns started at a time in our lives when we were very open to suggestion, our formative years. I would say that, just as a funny kind of analogy, if you told a three-year-old that the world works by jumping up and down on one foot, it would believe you because, it believes everything its parents would say. So these patterns run deep because we've been, indoctrinated and conditioned to believe that, that things work in a certain way. And of course, the most important relationships apart from ourselves that we have with ourselves is with our caregivers. And of course, that gives us the idea of what relationships are. Now, if you have a very dysfunctional relationship with your parents through neglect or abuse or just bad parenting, you have a certain view of relationships and you take that into your adulthood. At this point, it's very interesting to say that there's a Freudian concept called repetition compulsion, which says that when you go into your adulthood, you look for people similar to your parents to try to fix that original problem. And there's a very, very strong element of that in codependency, of course. And I believe it's true. Many people kind of think that it's not a worthwhile theory, but I actually believe it to be true because I see it. So these patterns run so deep because they really were given to us at a time when we couldn't decide not to adopt them, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and that makes so much sense. And I think what really lands there is that these patterns weren't chosen, they were absorbed. When you're that young, you don't have the capacity to question what love is or what love is supposed to look like. You just take in what's modeled and you adapt to survive. So of course those beliefs feel fixed later on. And what you're saying about repetition really resonates because it explains why people don't just move on with logic. They're not choosing from adulthood, they're choosing from imprint. And that's why willpower alone rarely breaks these cycles. It takes awareness. And yes, of course, that's really important, but also compassion for the fact that these patterns were learned when there was no real choice involved. That's what makes this work so deep and so important. What are some of the most common issues you see in modern relationships today? Because, as I mentioned, I do see those patterns often where people are questioning their choices. But for you, especially in couples who feel stuck or disconnected, what would you say are the most common issues?
Well, it varies. I mean, many people, and we'll take an example of doing couples therapy. I mean, many people think that people come into couples therapy after things like infidelity, which they do, or abuse. I don't know about you, but I don't see too many abusive cases, in couples therapy because people often separate after that kind of thing. But you see a wide range of different issues. Mostly it's about lack of communication. It's about codependency. It's about emotional distance on one side or the other. But also very, very interesting is that one of the things I've noticed is that you also get lots of what you would class as trivial issues as well. And on the surface they seem trivial, like, okay, who didn't stack the dishwasher properly, who didn't take the dog out, who didn't this, who didn't do this. But it always underlines a bigger problem of maybe control or emotional distance. So people do get stuck. And the main reason I believe that they get stuck is fear of the unknown. I mean, it's much easier to stay with the person you know, however imperfect it is, rather than go out there on the market and try to find someone new. But I always believe that life is also about taking some risk. And if you take that risk, you leave yourself open to possibility, but also to disappointment and rejection. The alternative is you stay in your comfort zone and have to face the consequences of that.
And I find that people keep wanting to fix things, but they're missing the emotional conversation underneath as well. And
Absolutely.
that's where relationships quietly stagnate, sometimes not through big blow-ups, because as you mentioned, I've come across many couples where if there has been conflict or abuse, those relationships do break up. But through the small moments of misattunement or something, they never get repaired from underneath. If it is something on the surface where there's arguments that naturally take place anyway, and I find that usually what helps people move forward isn't learning better arguments about things like chores. It's learning how to express need without blame, but it's understanding that need about themselves. And it comes back to what I said earlier, that self-awareness, knowing exactly what they are feeling, what their own emotions are, rather than wanting to please their partner and express their needs without that shame and without having to blame as well. And
absolutely.
Thank you, Nick, for sharing such valuable insights so far. We're going to take a short commercial break with a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Belinda Walia, and today I'm joined by the amazing psychotherapist and author, Dr. Nicholas Jenner. Before the break, we explored codependency, emotional safety, and relationship patterns. Let's continue. Welcome back, Nick.
Nice to be here again.
Now, communication breakdown is one of the biggest challenges partners face. What are the key ingredients of genuinely healthy communication?
Well, I think there are some standard things that you can look at, but there's some there's also, which I'll mention in a moment. But I mean, before we get to that, we have to say that conflict in particular is absolutely inevitable in a relationship. You've got two people, two completely different people coming together trying to form something, and of course there's going to be flashpoints. But when it comes to communication, people often feel that there should be no conflict, and so they try to avoid it. And of course, we can also look at the types of conflict that people have that often causes this communication breakdown. My experience, there's two types. There's that snappy, flashy kind of conflict when you go through your daily business, concentrate on something, and somebody asks you a question and you snap at them. Or there are the bigger things that you have to sit down and really work out. And I think we could also bring in the theory of the fast and slow response. The fast response is, of course, that you snap without thinking about it, even though your brain has processed it a few moments before. So it comes out before you even realize you've processed it. And then there's the slow response, where you can take your time to actually process an answer that would, move forward to conflict resolution. But I mean, when we're talking about effective communication, we're really talking about empathy. We're talking about empathetic listening, being present, paraphrasing, making sure you understand. And then, of course, empathetically speaking as well, using words that will kind of solve the conflict rather than escalate it.
Yeah, and it's about being curious instead of critical, mm-hmm. asking what's really going on for you right now, rather than jumping straight into defense and Empathy does slow everything down. You're right. It softens the tone. It turns a fight into a conversation. And when people feel understood, they naturally become less defensive, which is when real resolution becomes possible and conversations can take place easily. And a lot of people, I mean, we all know this, a lot of people do struggle to set boundaries without feeling guilty. How can someone begin building boundaries in a way that feels safe and empowering and healthy?
Well, that's a that's the golden question. I mean, many people find boundaries very, very difficult to set because, you know, as children, we're not taught boundaries and limits. We're told what to do and we're told what we're not supposed to do. We're told to be quiet. We're not allowed to express ourselves. And of course, people go into relationships thinking that boundaries are conflict. And they worry very much about, of course, the reaction from the other side and also whether the relationship will survive if they set a boundary. I think most people instinctively, once they learn about the theory of boundaries, will recognize that they probably already set some without knowing it. But of course, you know, that's a key point. You know, people have to learn what boundaries are and when to set them and, you know, what's the language associated with healthy boundaries. And I would say that they can really start, you know, in a safe place with somebody who they know will, you know, accept those boundaries, somebody close to them, somebody, you know, who's healthy and will realize that setting boundaries is a good thing. Because once you start setting boundaries and you start defining that space between you and somebody else, you will find that some people will drop off who are not, you know, who are not prepared to have the healthier version of you around. And this is what other people fear, I believe, is that they will lose those people. But of course, it's at the end of the day, it's really no loss. Yeah, so, you know, learning boundaries is a practical thing as well as an emotional thing. You've got to be, you know, it's part of a work that I tend to do as time goes on when the strength of self has come, when you can build up a little bit of the self, and then they see the real need to define a space between them and other people.
Yes, and thank you for that. And I agree, and that's why starting in a safe relationship really matters, doesn't it? Because practicing boundaries with someone who respects you builds confidence. It shows your nervous system that you can speak up and still be loved. And you're right, when you change, some people, of course, won't like it. Not because boundaries are wrong, but because you're old version was easier for them to access, control, or rely on, then that can feel uncomfortable, even painful, but it's also a sign of growth, isn't it? So, I appreciate you mentioning that, of course, we're not born knowing how to set those boundaries, and it's really important that people understand that about each other as well. So when you're in a relationship, of course, both people come from different backgrounds and some have unresolved childhood wounds or attachment styles, and that continues to affect their adult relationships, even when people think they've moved on. How do people resolve issues like that?
Well, I mean, I think the first step, as with most things that we could talk about in the mental health area, is awareness. Once awareness is there, then it's the action. And, you know, as we said earlier on, I think individuality is going to be part of our conversation later on. And I think that's the ultimate aim that people can kind of aim for. But we've got to remember that, you know, childhood trauma and attachment styles have a great effect on the way that people run relationships. And we have to remember that childhood trauma doesn't disappear, it just goes underground. And with codependency in particular, people subdue those kind of feelings of health so they can fit in with somebody else. And so they avoid conflict, or they're very hypervigilant in their environment to see how moods are changing. And so the childhood trauma that we all carry, the core wound, does affect the way we see a relationship. And our attachment style, of course, becomes a template for our adult relationships. Whatever looked like love in childhood becomes the blueprint for adult intimacy. And it will play out as well. And we do tend to recreate what we couldn't resolve as a child. Of course, we couldn't resolve much as a child, but then we recreate it, later on. And I think these wounds, they show up strongest in intimate relationships and, in various ways. And it's quite interesting to say at this point too that, that an insecure or anxiously attached or dysregulated person can also learn from being in a relationship with somebody who is securely attached, just by mirroring the behavior of that person.
Going back to what you were saying, and yes, because intimate relationships are where those early wounds feel safer to surface and where they hurt most, it's the closeness that activates them. You're absolutely right that we often recreate what couldn't be resolved in childhood, not consciously anyway, and because the nervous system is still trying to find different endings to the same story. And I really love what you've said about learning security through relationships, because healing doesn't only happen in therapy, it happens in safe connections. Someone who is securely attached can gently model that consistency and what it looks like and what calm conflict looks like and repair looks like over time. And that steadiness can begin to regulate again the nervous system that has only ever known unpredictability. So thank you for sharing that. And Nick, I feel that many individuals do repeat patterns though, and the rescuer role, always fixing or helping or carrying emotional weight, comes into play often in these kind of dynamics. How can someone break out of that dynamic?
Well, you've got to remember the function of the rescuer role is a key element of codependency, and it's a need to be indispensable in somebody's life so that if you're useful, then of course you keep that person around. Of course, it's not guaranteed that anybody's going to stay around whether you're indispensable or not. But the first stage, as we've said about many other things, of course, is to become aware of your patterns, which is something that codependents are very reluctant to do, because it might mean they have to make some changes. But once that awareness is there, and I will say at this point, Belinda, that I've considered myself a codependent for most of my life. And of course, I've played that rescuer role too. And you start to move forward when you can realize that, that you have to stop confusing responsibility with love. Rescuers, they don't help others because the others are helpless. They help because they want a return from that help. They want to feel loved for giving that help. So that's when it kind of loosens its grip. And then, of course, I call it AA, which is not Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's actually awareness, then action. Action has to be taken. And I think this is where a lot of people get stuck. many, many clients, and I'm sure you experience the same, is that they spend a lot of their time becoming aware over and over and over again. To the point of procrastination, and that jump between knowing and doing is a very, very difficult step for them to take. But once they can take that step through guidance, through a therapist, or I actually use internal family systems therapy to try and make that step, which is a very effective therapy for codependency. Then once they can make that step, you see that a self and individuality, which is always there, but just covered up, can start to form.
You're spot on about the rescuer too. They're not helping because the other person is helpless. They're helping to feel needed, valued and loved. And the fixing becomes their way of staying attached. And I love that you talked about the AA really lands, because awareness without action keeps people stuck. And at some point, knowing your pattern isn't enough. The real work is tolerating and the discomfort of doing something new, saying no, not rescuing, letting someone struggle, risking being less needed. And that's where the real shift happens, isn't it? And that self-responsibility plays a big role in your therapeutic work as well. I know that. What does healthy accountability look like in a relationship like this, if somebody does use the AA approach?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about an individual codependent who's been in a relationship, I mean, often when you come out of the relationship, you know, self-responsibility is absolutely essential. Now, what does it look like? It means actually believing in yourself. It means, you know, taking responsibility for your own decisions and your own life. It means creating individuality. Within a relationship, self-responsibility is a slightly different concept. And I'm always inspired by Stephen Covey, and he came up with what we call the three circles method.
Yes.
For relationship, which is you don't need to spend time explaining that to couples. You just need to show them the diagram. Two healthy individual people who have their own friends, their own purpose, their own, you know, kind of social circle, come together to create this third space for the relationship. It's the most healthy form of a relationship there is. You know, and you can always move that on as well. You can say, okay, if you spend too much time in your individual circle, your relationship circle suffers. And if you spend too much time in the relationship circle, then your individual circle suffers. So self-responsibility is about having faith in your own decisions. And, you know, and of course, then that comes in with communicating those and setting boundaries around those too.
Yes. And that's what healthy self-responsibility inside a relationship really looks like, where you're saying, I take care of my circle, you take care of yours, and we both take care of what we built together. And when couples truly get that visually, it often lands instantly, because they can finally see why feeling smothered or abandoned keeps happening, or those patterns keep repeating. Thank you again, Nick. Let's take another short break. We'll be right back after hearing a few words from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. Today's conversation is with the incredible Dr. Nicholas Jenner, who has taken us deep into emotional patterns, healing and connection. Welcome back, Nick.
Glad to be here.
Now, you've worked with hundreds of, maybe thousands of couples, both online and in person. What separates couples who heal and grow from those who stay stuck in conflict?
Well, that brings up the concept of couples therapy altogether. What we have to remember is that many people come into couples therapy when the rot has already set in. And many of them, you know, believe that when they come into couples therapy that you're going to save them. Because that's not a therapist's job, is to, you know, tell people to finish their relationship or ever, or even to stay together, but to put them in a position where they can make that decision themselves. Now, the difference between those who don't move on and those who do is a willingness to look at themselves as a couple and also as individuals. You know, it's every relationship that you could ever imagine will have issues. I'm always of the opinion, and I hold this very true, that we are all incompatible because we are individuals, and the successful relationships are the ones who can reduce that incompatibility by through compromise, by coming up with systems within the relationship that sustain the relationship. Conflict management, communication, and trust, honesty, respect, and the willingness to meet each other's needs as well as their own. Now, when you get people coming into couples therapy, as you know, there's lots of defensiveness, there's lots of stonewalling, there's lots of contempt and resentment going on. And as I said earlier, sometimes that rot has set in a bit too much. But when you get two people who really do say to themselves, okay, we want to take this time to work in therapy to improve our relationship and look at ourselves as a couple and as individuals, because I always think that individual sessions within couples therapy is also important. Yeah. Then, of course, you do get those couples who really, you know, work towards a vision, and that's a great position for them and the therapist to be in. Unfortunately, it's not always the case, and some couples, of course, don't make it.
I think it's also important to highlight that the couples who last aren't the ones who never clash as well. And I think that's where a lot of people fail. They're the ones who stay curious, stay accountable, and keep adjusting. Like yourself, Nick, I do the same. I think it's so important to build a healthy self-relationship. That's essentially what I'm talking about, the self-awareness, the self-acceptance, and then eventually that point where you get to that self-compassion.
Well, I mean, if you look at self-compassion and the way it's been marketed, you know, it can be rather fluffy and self-indulgent, wrapped up in pink bows and with bubble baths and champagne. But I always think that self-compassion is also about self-accountability.
Yes.
And, if you can find this self-compassion, it does change the tone of your inner world. And this is where internal family systems therapy really does work. And it also keeps you honest. Because what you've got to remember is that, codependency in particular, and a lot of the issues that we have, are down to relational trauma. You know, how we learn about relationships as children, and often the result of that is something's wrong with me. Self-compassion says, what happened to me shaped my world, it shaped my identity, but it doesn't define me. I think self-compassion is really self-compatibility. It's not a spa day. It's really about, okay, well, these are the decisions I want to make. This is what I want to work towards, And the unfortunate thing about a lot of the literature around self-compassion is that we've been taught to soothe ourselves rather than face ourselves, I always go back to a very, very famous book called The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. I think I've read that book 5 or 6 times. And, to paraphrase some of the themes in there, he says that self-confidence and self-responsibility comes from facing your issues. The famous line beginning, of course, is that life is difficult, but we seem to expect life to be easy, so we avoid everything. If you face your issues, you get through them, you find systems to work with your issues, it gives you self-confidence, it gives you this kind of glow that you're achieving something. And but instead of soothing ourselves, and we soothe ourselves in so many ways instead of facing ourselves. I mean, we've got modern technology with doom scrolling and things like this, it's very easy to escape that responsibility, which will bring self-compassion in the end.
Which is beautifully put. Thank you for that. Because when you face your issues, you stop being scared of them. You learn how you work, what your triggers are, what helps you regulate, and what support you need. And you don't erase the struggle. You build a way to live with it more wisely. And that's real self-responsibility, not fixing yourself in that aspect or not escaping yourself, but learning how to walk alongside yourself with honesty and courage and being very emotionally aware of what impacts you. What steps can help them rebuild that confidence within themselves again? So if we focus more on people that have been in long-term relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'd like to look at it from the codependent part. Yes. Because, you know, that's something I deal with a lot. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I mean, I created a program on my blog. It's called Therapy on Demand, which runs from, you know, understanding codependency to you know, what you do about it and moving into individuality. And this was one of the very things that I covered on that program, is how people deal with breakups. And really not just about codependency, even though they tend to have heightened emotions around breakups. But, you know, the one thing that I've noticed is that people don't want to sit, that they don't want to sit in pain. You know, they don't, you know, and most recognized methods of dealing with a breakup deal with that initial phase of allowing your emotions to come through. And it doesn't matter how you do it. There, you know, different therapists would have different ways. But I mean, what we tend to do is, because we feel life should be easy, we tend to subdue those feelings of anger, of shame, of, you know, of disappointment, of rejection. They're the very things that we should be facing in the very early stages of the breakup, whether we want to or not. And of course, we don't want to face those things, but they are essential things to face. And this is where internal family systems therapy really does get into the inner world and help. And then, of course, there's a progression. There's a progression depending on the how difficult the breakup was. For codependents, it's always difficult when they break up, because one of their massive fears, of course, is having to cope alone. And many of them cope better than they believe they do. And some of them go across to what we call avoidant codependency, where they make the statement, okay, I'm never going to be in a relationship again, which of course is a protection measure, until they find the next one, so to say. But you know, what I encourage my codependent clients to do in particular is to make sure that one, they're safe, particularly when they've been with somebody who's, you know, who's quite self-centered or you know, even, let's mention the word, narcissistic. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to keep away from them, of course, first, which means, of course, you know, dealing with their own emotions, but not finding excuses to contact that person. I've had all kinds of excuses as to why people make contact. You know, it's actually essential that they don't, but they always tend to leave one little open door that they come barging through, and it can be anything like, oh, it's the dog's birthday, or ludicrously, I heard once, oh, I feel better, I want to test myself by contacting and see how I feel. It's all a little bit of a ruse to maintain contact, because of course they're trying to control the outcomes.
Yeah,
but initially they've got to sit in those emotions. They've got to feel that pain. They've got to, you know, they've got to process those emotions. And then, you know, of course, the second thing is to make sure you don't get into a rebound relationship, you know, which a lot of codependents do. They process their pain with somebody else. And of course, the most disastrous thing that can happen is that you process your pain with your ex.
So incredibly powerful. Thank you for sharing that. What really stood out for me is that idea that pain isn't the enemy after a breakup, avoidance is. And sitting in those early emotions, as uncomfortable as they are, is actually where the real healing begins. And the way you explain the urge to keep one, tiny open door, just in case. I think so many listeners will recognize themselves in that. What you're offering people there isn't just theory, it's a clear recovery pathway, a safety aspect, safety first, no contact, emotional process, emotional processing, and absolutely no rebounding as a way of to bypass the work. That's not easy, but it's honest, and honesty is what actually sets people free. So I think what you've shared will genuinely help a lot of people listening today who are right in the middle of that raw post-breakup space. So thank you once again. And finally, for anyone listening who feels overwhelmed by repeated patterns in love, what's the first hopeful step they can take toward change?
Well, one thing is, if they've been stuck in repeated patterns in love, they need to be aware of those patterns and maybe the need to get professional help. Even though codependency isn't a disorder, and so there's no actual cure, it's a behavioural pattern from learned behaviour. Yes. There is a way of managing that, and the ultimate goal of particularly of codependency and likely anybody who's been in these repeated dysfunctional patterns is to seek and strive for individuality. Individuality is something that's very much misunderstood, and it's people think it's okay, it's shooting yourself in the middle of nowhere and having nothing to do with anybody, becoming lonely and isolated. That's not individuality. Individuality is finding yourself, you know, working out your life's values and your principles and living by them, and actually having people in your life who somewhat match those values. We're too keen to have anybody in our life so that we don't wish to be alone. And one thing that people don't realize, of course, is that individuality should exist in a relationship as well, as we talked about the three circles earlier on. Yeah. So the first step, hopeful step that they can take is try to be aware of their patterns. Now, that might come from repeated exposure to less than stellar relationships, or it might be somebody actually bringing it to their attention. But we do have to say at this point that, you know, anybody who is, you know, who is not aware is likely because they, you know, because they're in denial. And codependents are often in denial. I was for many, many years. And it takes something to break that denial. And when that could be a bad relationship that causes pain, or it could be, you know, somebody, you know, just bringing it to their attention, it could come through therapeutic work. But awareness is the key. Once someone can find awareness, then that's the kind of foundation to move on.
Such a grounded place to start, because awareness really is the doorway to everything else. Until someone can see the pattern, they're just living inside it. And you're right, denial isn't stubbornness, it's protection. It's how people survive what they're not yet ready to face. You've been wonderful, Nick. Thank you so much. And Nick, if anyone wishes to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Well, I have a blog where I do a lot of my work. It's called theonlinetherapist.blog. On there, you'll find details of that program I told you about. There's a YouTube channel called Therapy Shorts, where I do small podcasts on subjects that we've been talking about today. And of course, if they want some deeper work, I do offer an initial consultation, which is free without obligation. And they can contact me on safeharbor@drnjenner.com.
Thank you so much. That's amazing. You've been listening to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio with me, Belinda Walia. We close with a short version of the song Feel by Robbie Williams. Until next time.
I sit and talk to God, and he just laughs at my plans. My head speaks a language I don't understand. I just wanna feel real love, feel the home that I live in. 'Cause I got too much life
running through my veins, going to waste. I don't wanna die, but I ain't keen on living either. Before I fall in love, I'm preparing to leave her. Scare myself to death. That's why I keep on.